It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right, plenty to cover, starting with local and our state prosecutor, Rob McKenna.
Yes, well, he's Attorney General,
Attorney General,
and very much wants to be the governor in 2012. And as a consequence, you'll probably be hearing about this story again in a couple of years. A report came out this week that Rob McKenna's office, of course, he being the Republican, the preacher of fiscal responsibility, was responsible for nearly a third of all of the bonuses awarded to all state employees in fiscal year 2009. There was $1.9 million in bonuses awarded to Washington state employees, 599,000 of those to McKenna's staff. And not only was it a lot of money, but
those attorneys.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the average state bonus was $204. McKenna's staff, the average was $664. 55 of them got $3,000 each. And the bonuses went to almost all of his staff, 901 of the 1,321 people working in the Attorney General's office, which is a lot of people in the Attorney General's office, got bonuses. So nearly two-thirds of all those folks, probably all the senior folks, too, and all the attorneys, as you said. So the next time you hear a state Republican talking about waste in state government, you can ask them about Rob McKenna.
Yeah, and weren't the Republicans pushing Gregoire to, you know, to make sure that state employees weren't rewarded huge bonuses this year? Wasn't there some kind of special pressure put on her?
Oh, probably, yeah.
But it didn't have any effect when it comes to our Republican attorney.
Well, no, because they're not Democrats,
right.
So it's okay. If you're a Republican, it's okay.
Uh-huh.
All right, moving on. Case closed with the Port of Seattle.
Yeah, the feds closed their fraud investigation of the Port of Seattle this week with, and they didn't provide any real explanation as to what their findings were or what the evidence was in the case or even, you know, if they'd found anything.
Yeah, my notes read FBI closes POS investigation.
Yeah, that's about as brief as the announcement was. They said, well, we've closed the investigation, it's over, we're not bringing any charges. And I find that very interesting, given that what led to the investigation in the first place was a state audit that uncovered an estimated $97 million was wasted on the construction of the third runway.
And the third runway construction alone is just a little piece of the corruption down
at
the port.
Just a small piece of what goes on at the port. And the state auditor found that port commissioners were not doing an adequate job of oversight, that port staff were not informing them of what was going on, that port members were having these massive all-expense-paid lunches with heads of construction firms, and that many of the construction
firms...
At
the finest restaurants in Matsalam and Puerto Vallarta.
Yeah, steak and martini lunches. And that some of the contractors on the third runway made as much as double their usual profit margin after winning no-bid contracts from port employees. And the port had hired an internal investigator, former U.S. Attorney Mike McKay, to do their own sort of internal investigation and cleanup of the situation, and he found some pretty disturbing stuff. And yet he was denied the ability to look at much of the internal emails of port staff and to subpoena port employees for very important information. So even the constricted internal investigation that went on at the port found some disturbing stuff. So I'm kind of curious to know why the feds shut down their investigation and won't talk about it.
All right. Moving on, hung jury in the case of the King County Sheriff's Deputy?
Yeah, the King County Sheriff's Deputy was caught on video beating a teenage girl in a holding cell at SeaTac City Hall. Had his trial this week, and it came back with a hung jury, 11-1, 11 voting for his guilt and one person as the holdout that he was not guilty. What I found kind of interesting in this case is that the girl, the victim, had won a lawsuit against the King County, and she was paid a pretty generous settlement for that lawsuit. And usually when something like that happens, the person who is brought to trial for committing an act like that looks at the lawsuit, the civil lawsuit that's already been won, and his attorney tells him, look, you don't have a prayer of winning against a jury now. You should take a plea deal. Well, this guy was offered a plea deal with a reduced sentence, and he turned it down. So I'm wondering, you know, what's going on there and what happened with that one holdout jury member. Fortunately, county prosecutors said, well, you know, or fortunately, prosecutors in the case said, yes, we are gonna retry this case. We're not gonna let it go. But that doesn't always happen. We'll just have to see.
All right. Moving on. Looks like there's potentially higher taxes for corporations in Oregon.
Not corporations, but people who make more income. The state of Oregon has been in a very similar situation to the state of Washington and many other states, for that matter, with huge budget shortfalls due to the economic downturn and a lack of support from the federal government over the past number of years, unfunded mandates, etc. But Oregon responded to it this week very differently than the state of Washington has responded. They had a special election and passed with 54 to 46 margins, two tax increases geared toward high earners, and a hike for high earners income tax in the state of Oregon. And this, mind you, Oregon has a progressive income tax and no sales tax, as opposed to Washington, which has a high sales tax and no income tax. So an extremely
regressive sales tax.
Yeah, so the state of Oregon has a relatively fair tax structure, whereas the state of Washington is by far the most regressive in the country, as we've talked about on this program before. And for some reason, politically, the state of Washington seems incapable of talking about tax increases, even tax increases on people who are doing fairly well economically right now, even though it would not affect the vast majority of taxpayers. That discussion isn't even on the table in this legislative session. Instead, they're talking primarily about a budget that cuts essential services, especially services to people who can afford those cuts the least. It's a very, very different approach to governing, and a much worse one.
Yeah, and if you've been following the startup of the new Olympia Newswire, as I have, folks can find it online if they Google Olympia Newswire. You'll see that one of the reporters there is covering the economic beat in the Capitol this year, and he had an interesting article on how the state legislators sat down to talk about closing some of the business tax loopholes in the state of Washington, and they really couldn't get beyond just the basics of listing a few of them. They couldn't really discuss them, much less try to talk about initiatives or bringing laws that would close those loopholes. I found that to be an interesting article and just a good place to find out what the whole atmosphere in Olympia is like right now.
Yeah, because heaven forbid those corporations might fund your next reelection campaign.
Or they might decide not to.
Yeah, or they might fund your opponent.
Yeah.
All right. Well, moving on to national and the passing this week of the historian Howard Zinn.
Yeah, and there's really not a whole lot to say about that other than that we lost a giant this week in Howard Zinn's passing. And he went out the way you hope anybody like that would go out, age 87, and he was in Santa Monica to give a speech and had a heart attack. So even at that advanced age, he was out raising hell and fighting the good fight, and did that for many, many years. He was involved in the early civil rights movement. He was one of the few white advisors to SNCC, the Southern Nonviolence, I think, Coordinating Council or something like that, in the early 60s when he was on the faculty at Spelman in Atlanta, and moved up to Boston later, was an early opponent of the Vietnam War, and is, of course, best known for a people's history in the United States, and was not just a historian, but actively participated in many of those struggles over the last 50 years, and he'll be missed enormously.
All right. Moving on to this week's State of the Union address by President Obama.
Yeah, that was all the news this week, Obama's State of the Union speech. What I really took away from it was that he was mostly using it as a way to crack the whip with Congress to try to get some of his legislation passed. I think he spent about half the speech talking about all the initiatives he and the Democrats have pushed in Congress and that haven't been able to get passed, like the health care reform bill or the financial reform bill or his new jobs bill or the energy bill. There's just a whole long list of stuff that he talked about. And then he spent quite a bit of time putting the blame for the recession on the former administration, on the Bush administration, when in fact, if you really want to look at the history of how we got here, the roots go back at least into the Clinton administration and probably further back into the 1980s with the beginning of the deregulation of much of government function, including the financial industry. Well, he also discussed the bailout money and his proposed new tax on big banks and how that would claw back some of that bailout money for taxpayers. But of course, he made no mention of the much, much bigger amounts of taxpayer money that are being spent to prop up the housing market right now, to prop up Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which the government now owns the majority share in, and money spent through the FHA to issue risky loans to people who really can't afford the houses they're still buying, and initiatives by both the Fed and the Treasury to buy mortgage-backed securities from big banks and so continue to prop up the financial industry. If you put all that money together and try to add it all up, nobody really knows what the total amount is, but a good estimate would be about $7.5 trillion of an estimated $12 trillion total housing market is now being funded by the U.S. government. So he made no mention of that at all, and I found that to be very, very interesting.
Yeah, I came politically out of the initial punk rock movement, and one of the bands of that era had a slogan that talk minus act. Time minus action equals zero.
Yes.
And that came to mind listening to the State of the Union speech, because there was an awful lot of talk by Obama this week about, you know, all the pretty things that he would like to do. And of course, also during the State of the Union, it was enjoyable to see him dressing down the Supreme Court that was sitting in the front row for their corporate speech decision. But of course, I'm sure they were sitting there thinking, yeah, we've got lifetime appointments. You don't.
Yeah.
And but, you know, going through and doing a laundry list of all these things that the Democrats couldn't do and how it was all somebody else's fault, that's all technically true. But the meme that is out there right now isn't about that. It's about the Democrats have the White House, a huge majority in the House, and 59 votes in the Senate, and they can't get anything done. What the hell is the wrong with them? Because the Republicans had much smaller majorities than that in the last decade and managed to get really pretty radical things done. Of course, the Republicans had a spineless opposition in the Democratic Party.
Well, and it spoiled them, too, because now they think they can get anything done anytime.
Yeah, but the biggest thing that's hurting Obama and the Democrats right now is that there's been no explanation from Obama, in particular, as the sort of lead soapbox of the party, not so much about why things can't get done. He needs to explain how they're going to get done. And that's simply not happening. Instead, you have cheap political theater like the budget freeze that the administration announced the day before the State of the Union, where, it's not much more than the programs that he cut in the last fiscal year, about $15 million instead of $10. He exempted all military spending, which is the biggest growth area, as well as the hugest chunk of discretionary spending, over half of the federal budget. And if you're going to be serious about reducing the federal deficit, you have to start with the Pentagon. You had various other things that in terms of public perception go very counter to the meme of, the Democrats would be on your side except for those nasty Republicans. The White House pushed through the confirmation of Bernanke as the federal chairman this week, even though there's a huge populist movement in this country on both the right and the left that wanted to see him punished for his role in the economic downturn. You had Joe Biden talking about nuclear disarmament this week, even though the Obama administration budget asked for a huge amount of money, up to $7 billion, which is a lot more than last year, to make the nuclear weapons stronger in this country. So you have all of these things where the Obama administration is saying one thing and either doing nothing or doing the opposite, and that's really what's getting people pissed off.
Yeah, and it's interesting too. You know, you mentioned his announcement of freeze of you know, 1/8 of the federal budget and called it the discretionary budget, when in fact you're right, war spending is absolutely discretionary, and yet it's always viewed and continues to be viewed as an entitlement program, much like Social Security and Medicare, and it is mentioned in the same sentence as an entitlement program in most news reports.
And companies like those. Boeing and Lockheed Martin treat it like an entitlement program.
Exactly, exactly. And that's the very first step that Obama should have taken. He did inherit a budget deficit from the Bush administration, but what brought the federal budget to its knees were two things. One was the two disastrous wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the other was the Bush tax cuts for the rich. And Obama did not really adequately address either of those things in the first year of his term. And that's the reason why the American public from the left and the right are unhappy with him. And until he addresses the wars and ends those two disastrous sinkhole, you know, black hole money absorbing wars in two countries where we do not need to be right now, and until he repeals the Bush tax cuts, which have privileged the rich so that they can make money that is almost tax free in this country, he will not be able to close the budget hole.
On from there to this week's economic news.
Yeah.
I think we just covered it.
As if I haven't already talked about the economy. But, you know, there were some other stuff going on in the economy this week. There was some bad news for the housing market this week. In December, the first time home buyer credit had expired, and yet economists still expected new home sales to rise anyway in December because they thought, well, you know, the first time home buyer credit has given the economy a little boost and now it's going to take off. Well, what they found instead was the Commerce Department reported that in December, the sale of new homes fell by 7.6% from the prior month. That was a big drop and a big unexpected drop. And then it dropped 8.6% from a year earlier. So taken over the whole year, about 374,000 new homes were sold in 2009. That's versus what's considered a normal market where close to a million new homes is sold in a year. So that shows you what the housing market is doing, even with the federal government doing its best to prop it up and keep it going. And median new home prices were down 3%. Over the same period last year. So prices are continuing to fall even on absolutely brand new construction. And this is in spite of the fact that by December we knew there was going to be an extension of the first time home buyer credit through March. So that's showing you exactly how weak the housing market is. And when you take into account, too, that the federal government is going to end all of its programs supporting buying mortgage-backed securities and therefore their programs that were instituted to keep down interest rates so that mortgage rates would be low, they're going to end those by March 31st. I think by then we're going to find out exactly how weak the housing market is. Once that happens, my guess is that interest rates are going to rise pretty sharply and we're going to see a real end to home buying and a real price fall. And then this week also in economic news, we had the AIG hearings in Congress where Henry Paulson testified that, yes, he thought the bailout money that was spent was absolutely appropriate and he would do it again over and over and over again if asked to. And Timothy Geithner came up for a big scolding by some senators in the hearing. What I thought was very interesting was how he sat there and told them, well, by the time this whole bailout for AIG had been proposed, I had already recused myself as the head of the New York Fed. Well, a senator asked him, really, you'd recused yourself? Do you have the letter that you wrote recusing yourself? And he said, no, actually, I didn't write a letter. I just made sure that everybody in my office knew that I was no longer in charge.
Which, along with giving instructions for exactly what to do while I was no longer in charge.
Yeah, which to me, that's idiocy. I mean, no, that just doesn't cut it. So it seems to me pretty clear that Geithner really was still in charge when the New York Fed made the decision to hand bailout money over to AIG and to pay back those banks that had taken out credit default swaps.
At least it was a more imaginative excuse than I can't recall.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I can recall that I'd recused myself. Oh, no, I didn't really do it formally.
All right. Moving on to international, starting with Afghanistan.
Uh-huh. Yeah, this week there was a big conference held in London for a 65-nation conference to try to drum up some money for the Afghan war and a little bit of reconstruction money. Well, at that conference, Hamid Karzai had announced that, much to the surprise of his U.S. handlers, that he was willing to negotiate with the top leadership of the Taliban. Now, the U.S. position has always been, well, we will allow lower-level fighters of the Taliban to surrender themselves to us, and they will get amnesty and be able to take part in any kind of jobs program we have, et cetera, et cetera. But that the U.S. has refused adamantly to negotiate with any of the top leadership of the Taliban. Karzai just...
Sounds a lot like the Bush administration, doesn't it?
Exactly. It does sound like a complete holdover from the Bush administration. We do remember still have the Bush administration head of the Defense Department in office, so I guess that shouldn't come as any surprise. But Karzai said, oh, I want to negotiate with the top leadership of the Taliban, including Mullah Omar, who gave assistance to Al Qaeda, but who now says that, look, you know, we don't want to have anything at all to do with Al Qaeda. That is the official Taliban position, that if the Afghan government and the U.S. government will negotiate with them, that they will disavow Al Qaeda and have nothing to do with them anymore. But the U.S. just about had a heart, U.S. handlers for Karzai just about had a heart attack and were very quick to say, oh, no, no, that's not the official position.
All right. Moving on to the UK, where they've actually been having hearings on the road to Iraq.
Yeah, actually, several people in the so-called Coalition of the Willing have been having hearings trying to determine how their governmental leaders, fell for this swindle, essentially, from the Bush administration. And Tony Blair took the stand this week in London. He's basically persona non grata in the UK these days. And he said a number of interesting things. One of the things that I thought was most interesting about Blair's testimony was that he and his advisors knew that the invasion was illegal under international law, but they went ahead with it anyway because they thought that morally it was justified under their judgment. Now, you know, I might think that it's morally justified for me to rob a bank, but that doesn't change the fact that it's illegal somehow, and it really begs the question of why Tony Blair and the people who talked Tony Blair into this position, who were high-ranking officials of a country that shall remain nameless, why those people aren't in jail for what is considered under international law a crime against humanity, unprovoked aggression against a country that's done nothing to harm them.
Yeah, and you know, we really have no concept of what's going on in the UK right now with these hearings on the Iraq war. We don't get any coverage of it in the US press, but if you read the British press, you really see that Tony Blair and a lot of the people in his administration that supported the war in Iraq have been drummed out of office. Blair can't even get a job in the UK. He's working for the European Union as a Middle East peace negotiator. And when he tours for speaking fees, he tours in the US. He's very popular here, but he can't get a job. He can't hardly show his face in the UK. But he was there for the hearings this week, and I found it interesting when they asked him, you know, how can you justify this? He sat down and basically said, I think that Saddam Hussein really was responsible for 9/11. That's essentially what he said. And that, I'm sorry, that's been so discredited. And when he was asked by one of the legislators in Parliament, look, you know, do you have any regrets at all for your actions, for your illegal actions? He said, no, I have no regrets, and I'd do it all over again if I had the opportunity. There were women in the audience. There were women in the gallery where the public was sitting whose sons had died in Iraq, who just burst into tears and were yelling at him. And it was a pretty pathetic and awful scene, I'm sure. But we have, you know, nothing like that could ever happen in the U.S. George Bush and his cronies like Donald Rumsfeld and the other folks at the Pentagon who jumped on the Iraq War bandwagon, they will never be held account. They will never have to come before an inquiry like that, and I think they should.
Yeah, that's because, you know, in a parliamentary system, you can have bursts of actual democracy, and that doesn't seem to be capable in this country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, hearings have been front page in the UK press for weeks now, and no mention here in the U.S. All right, moving on to developments in Iraq this week.
Yeah, Chemical Haiti, Ali, remember? Chemical Ali, you remember him? He was one of the Saddam Hussein henchmen who was responsible for gas attacks against the Kurds and the Iranians in the 1980s. He was hanged this week, finally, a number of years after he'd been sentenced to death by the various kangaroo courts that came in after the U.S. occupation began. And it really, you know, he was the boogeyman before Zarqawi was the boogeyman. But he did it using a lot of components that he'd gotten from the United States and the United States military, because we were arming Saddam Hussein's side in the Iraq-Iran war, because we didn't like the Iranian revolution because of the hostage crisis and because we wanted the two sides basically to kill each other off. And then Saddam Hussein was also using those weapons against the Kurds and other domestic dissidents in Iraq. It's amazing the double standard there, where people like that who actually did commit war crimes can be held accountable, but somebody who a generation later dropped white phosphorus and illegally, internationally recognized chemical warfare agent on the citizens of Fallujah, for some reason those folks...
That was not Chemical Ali. That was not Saddam Hussein. That was the U.S.
That was Donald Rumsfeld.
Yes.
For some reason, those people aren't swinging from a gallows. And once again, as with the British hearings, it really begs the question of why these people are not being held accountable for what the international community considers the most grievous kind of war crimes against humanity.
All right. And briefly, Pakistan.
Yeah, a U.S. aid program for the Pakistani tribal areas. We got a report on that this week, that this $45 million program started in January 2008 with U.S. aid money to bring services and jobs to the tribal regions of Pakistan that border on Afghanistan, you know, the places where they recruit fighters for the Taliban, that program has largely been a failure in the 2 years that it's been running. Only $15 million has been spent, and the offices, which were based in Peshawar, had to be relocated to Islamabad for security reasons because all the workers in the program had targets on their back. So much for rebuilding Afghanistan and the tribal areas of Pakistan.
All right. And events.
Tonight there will be a benefit for Honk West, which is an annual gathering that's happened the last couple of years. A lot of fun of big percussion bands, folks like the Anti-Fascist Marching Band, and groups like that from around the country come to Seattle. They're having a benefit music show tonight from 8 p.m. to 2 a.m. at the Underground Event Center. That's 2407 First Avenue between Battery and Wall Street in Belltown. A lot of fun. Turn out there for that.
All right. Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchuk, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State comes out everywhere you get free publications King County Library System, bookstores, coffee shops, things like that. You've been having the chance to get them door to door recently because you got a guy going around town who is claiming to sell them on our behalf, but they are absolutely free. This guy is a scam artist. Don't give him any money. We never charge for Eat the State, but we are in a fund drive because we owe a lot of money to the printer, and we're actually trying to decide whether we can afford to continue the print publication or not. So if you'd rather have not just the website and the radio show, but also a newspaper that you can hold in your hands and give to your friends and have people pick it up wherever they might find free papers, please step forward now. We need to hear from you. We've really appreciated those folks who have helped us out. But if you haven't and you can, there's a PayPal button on the website at www.eatthestate.org, or send your checks or money orders. We need cash because we need to pay the printer and we need to decide whether we can keep doing this. The address is P.O. Box 85541, Seattle, Washington 98145. And if you want that donation to be tax deductible, or there's other ways you can help, or you need that information, just email us info@eatthestate.org.
And you need that response in the next week or so.
Oh, yeah, the next couple of weeks. We have to decide whether we're going to print the next issue or whether we're going to go to web only.